Let's start what we have come into the room to do.
Right on.
One, two, three.
Good afternoon, Ann Arbor and the world. You are listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. This is specifically It's Hot in Here Radio.
We are your co-hosts, Laura Smith
and Kat Superfisky. And today we are joined by the Ralph Obama. Yes, the Mr. Obama. It's actually Ralph Bauma. I've known Ralph now for, I think 4 years, was it? I took a class with him at the University of Michigan way back in the day when I was an undergrad, and it completely reshaped the way that I look at the world, the way that I was an environmentalist, and the way that I kind of have been trudging forward ever since. So it is a pleasure to have him on the show today. He wears many, many hats here in the city of Ann Arbor, as well as well beyond that. He is the pastor for academic ministries at the campus chapel here in Ann Arbor, and also directs the Center for Faith and Scholarship, which is a Christian study center at the U as well. And then you teach a couple different classes to the undergrad level as well in ethics and in policy for programming the environment. So welcome today. Thank you so much for joining us. And we're really excited to talk about our theme today, which is ethics and religion.
And
thanks, Kat. Good to be with you today.
So why don't we, before we really jump into that topic, start it off with a groovy little tune called This Land Is Your Land by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings.
This land is my land, from California, well, to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. I tell you, this land was made for you.
So before we get into this great conversation with Dr. Bauma here, let's do a little bit of environmental news, catch people up on what's going on today.
What is going on today?
Okay, Kat, do you want the good news or the bad news first?
Let's see. How about you lay... Let's start off with the good news.
Awesome. Okay, so today, April 2nd, is... Geez, the local food summit right here in Ann Arbor. We're talking about stakeholders from all over the food community here in Ann Arbor.
Wait, can we first talk about how it's already April?
Yeah. Welcome to April, by the way.
I guess we can focus on that one next in our in our next segment.
It is here. What we have going on today, though, is, I mean, we have people from all over the system, whether they're farmers, they're the people at the market, they're not-for-profits, they're educators, professors from the U, students, I mean everyone who is really passionate about local food and involved, you know, in the details of trying to bring it to Ann Arbor is at this conference today. So it's a really exciting thing that they spend a whole day kind of going over Michigan food history and local successes, like things that have happened this year for local food and positive stuff.
How many folks do you think are going out to something like that? Do you have an idea of how many people they were allowing to be registered?
That's a good question. I usually think it's somewhere between 1 and 200, I think.
Wow.
In my memory of going the one time that they had it at the Dana Building here on campus, I was able to go, and it was really, really cool. They filled up, you know, Dana 1024.
And they just have a lot of different informational sessions and things like that, and...
Yeah. It sounds like they had a really good Michigan food history guy this morning. People from Selma are always there talking about the, you know, the Hoop House initiatives.
Our engineers, Shannon Brines and Jeff Tenza, they are on vacation there today.
Oh, I mean, Shannon organized the thing. So he's been part of the homegrown festival organizing activities. So we're so proud of everything that he's doing.
So that's the happy news.
That's the happy news.
Now, what's the not so happy
news? And
that's
on the local scale. Let's go up to a bigger scale here. So it came out that just, I think, 2 days ago, Bill McKibben, who is known for his massive organizing of the 350.org movement, is stepping down from his position there.
And did he give any reasons for that?
In the brief write-up that I'm looking at right here, it looks like he's just worn out. Let me see if I can find... my data. I want to find it in his words.
Yeah, give it to us straight.
All right, here's what he said. I'm bone tired and written out. It's time for the planet to take care of itself. McKibben told a crowd of supporters who were sweating in the freakish early spring heat wave that rolled across much of the U.S. I'm going skiing, he said. Make that water skiing.
How old is Bill McKibben?
Ooh, who knows?
Is he in his 40s only?
I would guess
he?
He's in his 50s.
In his 50s?
Mm-hmm. He's
burnt
been writing.
Out in his
he's
50s.
Been talking.
So young.
I mean, I think he really burned himself out on this last. I mean, it's been, what, 2-3 years of really strong global organizing on, a really hot topic.
Well, and he's been... Right? hot topic. He's been going strong since his late 20s. I mean, he wrote End of Nature back when he was, I think, 29. Mm-hmm. So I feel like he's probably been, you know, just blowing full steam ahead for, gosh, 20 plus years.
I mean, and what I don't know is I wonder what factors are that led... I mean, I think he was to his burnout here. I'm sure it's years. But what happened with 350.org specifically that he feels like he's hit a wall? I'm not sure. It doesn't elaborate.
Do you have the Globe or the Inquirer, any of those kind of raunchy magazines up? Because maybe if we got on their websites, they'd have some good dirty stories
good
on McKibben and some justifications for why he chose to leave.
No, I'm not sure yet. I guess we'll kind of watch as the news unfolds. But I do think it, in my mind, it leaves a really interesting question on how much does a movement like this, like climate action, need a figurehead? Versus, you know, you look at Occupy movement or other things like that that don't have a clear person behind them, but are these really organic, massive movements.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to watch what happens to 350.org.
Well, and to a lot of environmentalists, too, if their figurehead steps down and says, I've had enough, I'm burned out, Mother Nature, go save yourself. That's kind of hard for a lot of other folks who look up to McKibben or who reference him. To actually say, all right, well, I'm going to have the stamina and the wherewithal to keep actually going. I feel like it could really have a giant ripple effect that he's not necessarily mm-hmm. expecting.
I mean, and it does, like you're saying, it actually brings up some really good questions about what it takes to sustain the people doing this work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think we can get into some of those conversations here today as we even talk about how religious communities are helping people be active, because maybe part of it is not being the solo big person who puts yourself out there and burns yourself out. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's not quite the right model. Or it's really awesome that he did this great service and we're thankful to him, and maybe it's time for him to take a break and join his communities and do something else for a little while and restore.
Well, I definitely know one thing that gets me excited and wants me to keep going, and that's Raffi.
Ooh, let's hear it.
We're just going to do a brief clip of this amazing song called Evergreen Everblue to put our frowns upside down and get us back into the environmentalism.
It's coming, we promise.
Evergreen, everblue.
Amazon is calling to help this planet Earth. With voices from the jungle, help this planet Earth. Hear the tree that's falling, help this planet Earth. Rainforests are crying, help this planet Earth.
So the reason that I decided to play that song today, there actually is a reason other than the fact that Raffi is amazing. I really encourage all folks out there, all of you in listener land, to check out the album artwork of Raffi on this Evergreen Everblue album. You can probably only find it in cassette tape, maybe on eBay, Amazon, something like that. But oh, it was awesome. It was Raffi's face, and then on his cheeks and everything was the world. And then his beard were these pine forests, and pretty much all I'm trying to say is that listening to Raffi growing up in my backyard really made me an environmentalist. It was one of the things that I kind of, you know, attribute to the fact that I give a rip about the planet today. Nice. It's listening to music like that and thinking about things like beluga whales and things outside of even just my backyard and outside of just myself. But that being said, there are a bunch of different reasons for why folks look towards the environment and actually care about it and do actions that try to help it. And that's kind of what we want to get into today, is how we have ethics that go towards environmentalism and how even religion can play into that.
So, Rolf, can you tell us a little bit about your own story, how you came into the topic, where you are today?
It actually started fairly young. I grew up in a family that my father was a pastor in a small rural community. And one of the things about being a pastor in a small rural community is when you get vacation, you leave town. Otherwise, you still are the pastor and you're not on vacation. So by the time I was 12, 14 years old, I had traveled most of the U.S. We always ended up going on long trips. We would visit most of the national parks. My dad was quite an outdoorsman. And so we would make swing through the Pacific Northwest. We would go through the Maritime provinces. We would head down south. And I had seen, you know, much of the U.S. and Canada by the time I was in my early teens. And being a somewhat reflective person, that ended up intersecting with what I experienced within my own religious tradition and the practices, Sunday worship and Bible study and reading and the like. There was a lot of references to nature. There was a section in the hymn book that would have been labeled Creation and Providence. And the interesting thing is that what those hymns talked about was not what was oftentimes talked about in the public arena and in the culture wars, things like creation versus evolution and those sorts of things. But what was found in the hymns were celebrations of the variety of life, and it talked about the relationship between God and the world and a human place within it. And it was easy to make that connection. So I grew up loving the outdoors. I grew up with a scientific mindset. The high school that I attended was best in the sciences. I fully expected to go into the sciences, and then I got to college and ran into history and philosophy and ideas. And I never turned back to the sciences in any kind of formal way. But I always retained that interest and was always wondering, what does this mean? So when I ended up in academics after college, I ended up going to law school. And there I worked on environmental law. And, you know, I would have been very interested to practice that long term. It was a little bit of a difficult time in environmental law. It was the beginning of the Reagan administration. Yes. It was a difficult time. So what I did was I was interested in the foundational questions. Why do we care about these things? What is their status? And now that I know a little bit more about it, what I was asking was questions in the philosophy of nature, which in our culture and in most of Western civilization for the last 200 years, we haven't thought there was such a thing academically. But I thought there was. And I found a few other people that thought there was, some people in reading. And I also found that in my own theological reflection on my faith, that there were some really deep questions. And so after law school, I didn't end up practicing law. I went back to first a seminary, and then I went and got a PhD and did it in the field of eco-theology. And my specific focus was on the genetic alteration of plants and animals, but basic questions about, I mean, who the heck do we think we are?
I didn't even know eco-theology existed as a degree program. Now I know.
I have expanded your world.
Thank you.
And probably changed your course track.
Yeah, I'm going to change my whole dissertation.
That'll be
now.
Another
it's
6 years.
It's almost done, but I, you know, might start again.
Why not?
No, but that's really cool. And, I mean, are there programs... Are there numerous programs like this, or is this is probably still a pretty special thing to be housed in the universities?
Well, I did my work at Boston University. There are other programs in which you can do things in the field. There's certainly a whole range of programs that deal with the question of what is humanity's relationship to the world around it? What is the status? I mean, and when you get down to, you know, basic questions that we're dealing with nowadays, what do we eat? How do we raise it? A species is in danger of going out of existence. What is a species status? And those kind of things. They're deep, deep philosophical, religious questions. And if you go back and read the deep ecology writers from the 70s and 80s, they were very aware that you couldn't do ecology on a shallow surface level. You had to get down to some basic foundational questions that... were at least philosophical, and most of them were religious.
So how come it is that not everyone who is, you know, has a religious upbringing or who goes to church or is familiar with the Bible picks up on those kind of tones and messages within the scripture, within the hymns and things like that?
Well, I think it ends up being that a tradition ends up sliding in certain directions, and you end up the biblical tradition in both the Jewish and Christian traditions, you end up spending most of your time, you spend 80% of your time in 20% of the literature. And other things just sort of drop by the wayside because at one time in the tradition, there were certain needs and you had a focus on certain things, and these are the things that come out and become emphasized. And for, you know, several centuries, the question starting in about the 1500s, 1600s, the issue was, how is it exactly that humans achieve salvation or repair their status with God?
Mm-hmm.
Very narrow focus. There was no debate within the Western Christian tradition about what the status of the world around us was. Creation got no attention. When it did get attention, it was not a helpful tradition in the early part of the 20th century, when the culture wars of the fundamentalist movement and creation evolution came forward. And so we forgot how to talk about these things. And it is interesting to me that where it does stick around is in the singing tradition. if people actually did what they sang, they would act in a very different way. And there are many texts in different parts of the scriptures that, that end up touching on. So, for instance, the Psalms, there are, you know, several dozen creation psalms. Some of them are really beautiful. Did not get used much. Jeremiah 4, I think, is a fascinating passage. It's from the prophetic literature in both the Christian and the Jewish tradition. It is, has been described by Bernard Anderson as the text of the ecological crisis, because what it does is it describes the decreation of the world in response to human stupidity. And you just read it, and it's, you know, sort of the world comes apart at the seams, and it just sort of perfectly describes the environmental crisis. I'd be interested to go back and how many people actually preached or studied that text. Virtually nobody, but it's there and it's prominent.
So do you think that there's the potential to focus that 20% in a different way, to be able to, given kind of the state of the world now, and that we, you could term it kind of this environmental crisis, that religion can really be used as this medium of communication and of education and awareness building, and to activate folks in terms of kind of pushing the attention less towards salvation and things like that written in the scripture, and more towards kind of the underlying how to be a steward of the environment and things like that. Is that potential there?
Certainly, and it certainly happened as well over the last 40 to 50 years. It's interesting, if you go back in the 1930s and 40s, there was a professor in Chicago by the name of Joseph Sittler. His sermons are collected, and he was Rachel Carson 20 years before Rachel Carson was. You just read his, and it's just, he's finding all these themes, and he's connecting them with what's going on in the world at a time when even the culture at large had no inkling that this was an issue. He was one of those world historical figures, in a way that Newt Gingrich never will be, who is ahead of his time. And now you find a lot of those emphases being found. And they were rediscovered in the 60s and 70s, and now, at least within a significant segment of the religious community, these are now more or less commonplace. And so there is a shifting and an appreciation of these things. And certainly when I go around, if I ended up preaching a sermon as part of a religious service and touch on and use one of these texts, I don't have people saying, where the heck did you come up with that from? It is repositioning, but it still has quite a ways to go.
So it seems like people are pretty open to those kind of messages and those, you know, that kind of
it's a reframing,
a
basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In many places. If you, I had a colleague once who said, when you're preaching on something where you're trying to shift people's mindset, what you do is, he described it as you bang the drum slowly and you march from the center. And what he meant from that by that was, what you do is you take some very simple themes and just repeat them over and over again, and eventually it soaks in, it sinks in. And I think that has happened. And so if I go into most churches nowadays and preach, say, on Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, and make that relation to, you know, hey, people, we have to be, we have to have a sense of our own place. This isn't ours to do with as we please. We have responsibilities both to the earth and to God. I'm not going to get people coming after me and say, that is the most heretical thing I have ever heard. No, they've absorbed it. It's now becoming a part of the ethos.
That's a brilliant segue to a song called Responsibility.
By Grand Funk Railroad.
That's the one.
Shake it, kick it, sail along down here. And when I want
All right, Ann Arbor. You are listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. This is It's Hot in Here Radio. This week we're joined by Dr. Rolf Boma.
Not Obama.
I was feeling presidential. You could have called me that.
Keep Dr. going. Rolf Obama.
Right, we're talking about religion, environmental ethics today. So, Kat, let's.
Yeah, and something that I'm interested to learn more about is how the religious community is already kind of posited itself in the environmental movement and what kind of stances they're taking on certain things, how maybe they're helping to mobilize folks and citizens to understand more about stewardship behind the environment, things like that.
It's actually been for the last 20 to 30 years, there have been a number of movements. There's the National Religious Partnership in the Environment. There's the Forum on Religion and Ecology down at the University of Florida. The Evangelical Environmental Network has been around for several decades now. An organization that I'm involved in, the Ausable Institute for Environmental Studies, is a Christian Environmental Studies Center. And there have been some pretty significant efforts in terms of connecting the religious community and trying to reshape it in terms of its stewardship of the world and connection with other environmental activities. Just take the Evangelical Environmental Network as an example. They were famous, or some might say infamous, a few years ago for having the "What Would Jesus Drive?" campaign. that was the response of most people. It was sort of a chuckle about it and sort of what an inane question. And at one level, it is. On the other hand, there were a lot who misunderstood it. And, you know, they tried to say that, obviously these people at the Evangelical Environmental Network are naive and they're a bunch of Luddites and they're trying to imply that Jesus would have ridden a donkey.
He have walked? I would have thought he would have walked.
He would have driven a Prius. Hello.
Know about that.
Well, actually, that was they in effect accomplished what they wished. Now, whether they did that without sullying their reputation is another matter, but they did get people talking about it, and you know, a number of people in Illinois said could well be that Jesus would drive a Prius, but it was also, you know, raised up he would walk. Well, pedestrian is not a bad thing to be, and it raised the question, and people got thinking, you know, instead of this, what would Jesus do in just solely a personal morality sort of question, it translated it out into broader question. Now, recently, the Evangelical Environmental Network started another campaign, and this has engendered a lot of discussion. This is, they came out in support of the mercury emissions legislation. And the way they did it is say, mercury emissions is a pro-life issue. And boy, did that push some buttons.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And but they ended up getting a lot of people within the religious community and came out and say, pro-life does encompass these issues. You can't just interpret it so narrowly that it excludes. This is a pro-life issue. Now you get some others who can't say that's watering it down, all this sort of stuff. But there are some significant efforts that are going on into leading the religious communities to reflect on these things and then take some action. It's interesting, within one segment of the evangelical community, the Vineyard Church, in the last 5 years, there's been a sort of eruption of environmental awareness and responsibility. Started in all places, Idaho.
Hmm.
Not a place you would think of as being a hotbed of environmentalism. But a pastor out there became convicted of it, and his community got involved, and it sort of spread like wildfire through a number of communities. And it gave rise to a number of some videos and some books and things like that. And there's actually a fair amount that's going on and has gone on.
Well, that kind of brings in the issue of leadership, right? I mean, we were just talking about Bill McKibben and 350.org earlier and this question of a figurehead, but, you know, to what extent is it really critical for personalities within these organizations to really take this on, to, you know, to share it, to be convincing? And I mean, what you're saying here, too, is they're taking values people already have and showing how some environmental ethics are consistent with those values. So they're helping people connect dots. So, you know, I'm bringing up a couple of things here, but it sounds like we're talking about leadership and communication.
And that is true. There are some people who have exercised a lot of leadership in this regard. It also highlights some of the tensions within the community, because you have some leadership that's been around a while and that feels threatened by some of the changes, and there's resistance. This has played out in the organization called the National Association of Evangelicals, where the executive director a few years ago, a man by the name of Rich Zizek, who especially began to give leadership on the issue of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up, after a couple years of significant activism and reshaping the culture of the organization, was forced to step down on another issue. But the thing that was really lurking behind it was resistance to having climate change be addressed seriously. Now, Rich Zizek has stayed very involved in environmental issues, and he's still a spokesperson in many regards. But there is a transition in a number of religious communities between older leadership and younger leadership. The younger leadership tends to be more open to having environmental concerns be a major part of the their platform.
So is it normally that just, individuals or churches or regions kind of take a stance, or is it that the entire kind of religion then takes a stance on something? Is it up to smaller kind of pockets?
Kind of grassroots versus top-down?
I mean, does Christianity in total have a stance on endangered species, have a stance on population control, have a stance on climate change? Or is it just kind of these, more of the individual folks that are taking the stand and saying things?
That depends on the religious community and how it's structured. So, for instance, within the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. they will have official declarations and statements, and you can go and find what is the official Roman Catholic position on a certain subject. But you will also find, even within the Roman Catholic community, that there is a wide diversity of opinions, and there are sort of subsets within it. So, for instance, within the Catholic community, you also have a branch that's known for what's called creation spirituality. That has a heavy emphasis on creation and creation care. And that filters into the rest. And really, the statements of the Roman Catholic Church overall are very positive in terms of the need to be concerned about the environment. It tends to be pretty human-centered, but it's overall, it's very encouraging that we have these responsibilities. There are other communities that are much more grassroots. The Vineyard movement, that was largely a grassroots movement. Within the Amish and Mennonite communities, they are so decentralized that almost everything has to be grassroots.
Mm-hmm.
But you get different levels of organization. Evangelical churches tend to be pretty dispersed, but they try to get together on some social matters. There you had a very interesting phenomenon. They knew that the rank and file would probably not want to address climate change on a formal basis. And so the effort back in, I think it was 2006 or thereabout, what they did is a roundabout way. They went to Christian college presidents, and they went to leaders of religious social network organizations, and got over 200 of them to sign a climate change document. And that really upset the old guard,
mm-hmm.
because they saw it as an end run, which in a way it probably was. But it really did focus that the institutions that were at the forefront of dealing with these issues and education, like, they were committed and saw it as important. And that was concerted action that then ended up filtering out and down.
I mean, and there is sort of this thing happening on the level of denominations, but I also know there's organizations that are working across denominations, right? And maybe that's more regional, local scale, but I was just listening to a talk Friday from, I forget the name of the group, but, a local churches who were getting together to try to work on energy efficiency in church buildings together across, Judaism, Catholicism, all kinds of different, they all have the same issues that they're dealing with and they're trying to come together. So I think that's pretty cool to see too.
You're probably talking about the Interfaith Power and Light movement.
That's it.
And that's in most states, and been very effective in getting religious communities to address matters of energy consumption and think about when they're doing building projects. It's interesting, here in Southeast Michigan, one of the most effective and really for showing forethought, the Immaculate Heart of Mary in Monroe, which is a community of elderly nuns whose mission is to take care of even more elderly nuns. So the average age of the community is in the 70s, and the average age of those being cared for by the community is over 90.
Wow.
Now, if you want to talk about a community that would seem to be, what stake do we have in this?
Mm-hmm.
But when they have done building, retrofitting, and the like, it's cutting edge. And they've done some incredible work there, and so they're rebuilding their campus, but building it at very high environmental standards. It's an amazing thing.
So why? Why pick something like, you know, energy efficiency within a building to be gung-ho about and create these kind of councils around and initiatives and take that instead of the million other kind of stances you could take on environmental, you know, regulations and stewardship and action?
It shows how religious communities, when they get together and talk about the issues that are important to them, it has an opportunity to work its way through the community. And the community makes a decision as to what it thinks is important. And this community of nuns, these sisters, said, for the future, this is what's important. And we will use our resources to do this right. And, you know, it's really impressive.
So then what happens if there are two competing ethics, if you have, you know, a stance on two different things, that one might be for you know, being a steward to the environment, the other might be for something else that's written in the scripture. What wins? What, you know, how do you, is it just up to individual person to figure it out, or?
Well, individuals have to tend to, you know, sort through things through themselves, but that is where religious communities and the ethos of the community ends up really making a significant difference. So within the Mennonite community, you deal with consensus.
Mm-hmm.
You do not move on something until you have general agreement. It may not be that everybody agrees that's the best course, but it means that everybody agrees that we are going to take this course because this is what the community has come to discern is where it should go. And a few years ago, I had Paul Seelbach, who's a professor here at who works with Great Lakes Fisheries and was involved with the Michigan Great Lakes Groundwater Advisory, come in and give a lecture. And he talked about how his experience within the Mennonite Church ended up impacting the way the Groundwater Council did its work and how they had consensus as the goal, and over a 6-year period came to not only within the group, but also then legislatively a sense that this is where Michigan had to go in terms of groundwater protection. And it meant that in the implementation phase, things went so much more smoothly. It was not the adversarial, antagonistic kind of situation that so often comes to bear in these cases.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, why don't we cut to another tune real quick before getting into more heavy stuff. So why don't we go to A Long Way to Go by Railroad Earth? Because, boy, do we have a long way to go.
A little ways to go.
Seeking out a sound. Come on, bend your ear down low to the ground. Where you might find a little clue in the rumbling of what is to come. You can take this lying down, or you might hold up in your town. But you can take some time out for yourself. But it's just you now. And if you can't trust us, well, who can you trust? Oh, well, now your hi-fi stereo's gonna tell you where to go, yeah. But how you gonna get there without us? Lord. y'all seeking out a court. And you're still living by that sword. Ooh, I know you're out of fear of rumbling. What is to come? You can't keep your hopes at toy. The right hand of your old landlord. Oh, you can take some country for yourself. Just you now, and all of us. Honey, and if you can't trust us, well, who can you trust? Oh, well, now your hi-fi stereo's gonna tell you where to go, yeah. But how you gonna get there without us? 'Cause we're everywhere. No, now there ain't no way. Apart from frost, you might minimize your cause by taking little time out in the country for yourself. Well, it's just you now and all of us. Honey, and if you can't trust us, well, who can you trust? Oh, well, now your hi-fi stereo's gonna tell you where to go, yeah. But how you gonna get there?
Did you guys listen to the harmonica on that one?
Ay, ay, ay.
Hopefully you guys out there in
hot
listener land
did. Stuff.
That's just a tune to get your toes a tapping and to get you to realize that we do have a long way to go. Hopefully.
We're
hopefully
working
we're not
on
going
it.
Extinct.
A lot of people are working on it.
So, Rolf, let me ask you this. How is it that, because I see, you know, the religious movement as very separate from the environmental movement in terms of a lot of people. How can we get more communication happening between these kind of groups and have kind of cross-pollination between initiatives and folks working together?
One has to realize that there is actually a fair amount that's happening right now. A lot of it happens behind the scenes. Let me just give you an example here and there at the University of Michigan. What are the number of professors in environmental studies who are also part of religious communities? My guess is it's a significantly higher percentage than what you might suspect.
Mm-hmm.
I've officiated at local Ash Wednesday services, and it's always thought-provoking to have one of your colleagues come up and you're imposing ashes on their forehead and realize this person's a part of a religious community and has a religious convictions, understanding of the world. And so it's there. I do think that there's a significant issue with compartmentalization. And so we have been taught here in the U.S. we compartmentalize our religion. It's private, and we practice that there. And then we have these other things that we do. One of it is we have environmental concerns. In my class, for example, I'll frequently, I do a section on religion and ecology, and I'll ask them, 25% of the students at the University of Michigan say that they are affiliated with the Roman Catholic Church. That's what the statistics have regularly shown. What does a Roman Catholic approach to scripture, to environment? And it's always interesting that the vast majority of the Roman Catholic students don't have any idea. I've occasionally had one that said, yeah, we talked about this in my Catholic high school, and gives a very brief but accurate and compelling statement of how their faith leads them to deal with environmental issues. It strikes me, though, that for so many others, there's been no connections made between what was said here and then what's going on here. And I think it does need to be made more overt. We need to sort of bring it out in the open. And a number of environmental organizations have begun efforts. I believe it was Natural Resources Defense Council had a program a few years ago on religion and the environment. I remember seeing a video a few years ago from it was an environmental issue out east, and a director of an environmental organization, they had made some progress by being able to get into churches and tap into some of the religious beliefs of these people to change a whole set of behaviors. It was a really very interesting thing. But what the director of the organization, his analysis of it was, he said, you know, we never thought of it that we could use Jesus to affect this change.
Mm-hmm.
And sitting in a group of people of religious background, I could see real discomfort there. It's like, we're having our faith manipulated to achieve a certain end. And that is where there is some tension that ends up going on. Whereas if there is some support, there is a recognition of that religious communities are carriers of value, that they have understanding of the world and why it's important, and that we have these responsibilities and obligations, and this is the way they live themselves out. I think that there is an awful lot that can be done in bringing them together, and actually there is a lot. If you look at national environmental organizations, there are a significant number of people of faith. Head of the National Wildlife Federation is a Christian. I've served on a board with him in the past. A number of major figures. And there is this cross-pollination that goes on.
So how do you think that we can foster more of that? And do you think that more of that will be happening in the future, from your opinion?
I do. It's the sort of thing that takes time. I mean, I'm admittedly getting to the age where I can see these changes taking place. And I can look back to what it was in the 70s and 80s and realize the conversations have changed. It will, and even some just slight changes will end up making people open to things that they wouldn't have been necessarily in the past. So that... you know, the communities of which I'm a part and that I intersect with, as I said, really are open to concern for the environment and recognize that we have obligations and we have to be concerned about these things. And I just gave a chapel at a Christian college back in early February, and, you know, it was on species preservation. And it invoked some passage from 1 Kings, and it was about how do we exercise wisdom with respect to this world. And there was a great deal of appreciation for that. And there was nobody out there going, like, this is totally irrelevant to what we're about. So I think that there is quite a bit, and I think that the environmental movement will certainly benefit from the energy and commitment of religious communities.
Yeah, religion has an extreme, extreme amount of power.
Well, yeah, and I mean, what I'm thinking is that it's ready-made community, ready-made institutions that already have a sense of, you know, values, morality, trying to get together, people coming together face-to-face to talk about those issues. That's already happening,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's ready-made. It's, you know, there's a lot of topics you can bring in that kind of forum, right? Environment being one.
Mm-hmm.
There is a caution, and that is that one of the things, religion is sort of a network of beliefs. In the sense that I use the term religion, it's not just isolated practices. It's not certain rituals. It's not dogma that's handed down from above. It's a complex set of beliefs about what sort of the nature of reality is. There's some very complete pictures of what the world is like, and you know, hopefully that they're held with some humility, and not we've got all the answers and everybody out there is dead wrong and the like. But one of the facets of it is, and this is really tricky, you just take one aspect of it and change it ever so slightly, and it changes the whole orientation. So I have gotten the question sometimes when talking about the environment, and this is one that's, most people might be aware of, but I've had a few people who say, look, if the world is going to end soon, why do we care about it?
Mm-hmm. This is religious people asking you that, saying that, or anyone?
Yeah, this is within a church community at an educational session after I've talked about environmental matters. And, I want to be, one thing, I find very little emphasis myself on the end of things within the Christian tradition. I find that to be an obsession that some people have. But the fact of the matter is, we're told within the tradition that no one has an idea. No one's informed. We have no idea how long life is going to go on, this world's going to go on. And the great thinkers within the tradition, something like Martin Luther, who said, if I knew the world was going to end tomorrow, I would plant my apple tree today. If something is the right thing to do, you do it regardless of how long it's going to go on. Mm-hmm. But you do get within the tradition some people who, it's just one slight change, and suddenly they feel some of the impetus for care for the world. And within most religious traditions, this isn't just Christianity, but it's true of Buddhism and other traditions as well, you almost always end up with a segment that is what I would call world denying. Sort of the best way to go is to distance yourself from what's going on here. And it's very hard to have any kind of environmental consciousness if you really think that what happens in the mundane world doesn't matter in the long run. So I want to be careful. There certainly is a lot of power, a lot of possibility, but even a slight change can veer things off.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you point folks towards resources that if they want to learn more, if they want to think more about ethics and philosophy and how religion even relates to those things, anything like you were mentioning in terms of the deep ecology movement? I mean, if anyone's been to your office, they know that you have a massive bookshelf with just numerous books of various types. So any books that you would recommend people reading, websites, any, classes to take other than obviously your environmental ethics class, which was awesome. Anything that you can point listeners towards?
Well, there's certainly some really, really excellent works out there. Let me think. In sort of a general relationship to the world, I love Annie Dillard, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
So her Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, I think, is a must-read. She writes from a sort of mystic tradition that has probably one and a half of her feet in the Christian tradition, but the others are, she's very familiar with Buddhism and Judaism and the other and other mystical strains. And in terms of just an orientation to the world, I love reading her and think that she's really great. There are some really good authors, Bill McKibben being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I still think his book, The Comforting Whirlwind, which is a reflection on the last five chapters of the book of Job, is a great piece of literature. From within the Protestant tradition, there's a book called For the Beauty of the Earth. It's written by Stephen Baumeprediger. He's a professor of religion at Hope College, and really excellent treatment. Almost anything in the BT 695.5 Library of Congress segment.
Nice.
Was that a little
look
bit?
At you go.
That just gets everything else out there. Yeah.
Was that a little bit too pedantic?
Yeah. It was perfect.
Anyway, there's some really good stuff out there, and some of the statements. I think the Evangelical Climate Change Initiative, it's a great simple statement of how a religious perspective shapes one's responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Thank you. Ralph, I really can't thank you enough for coming in and spending the last hour with Laura and I and just being able to talk about this kind of topic, something that is definitely uncharted territory here, and it's hot in here, which is, an environmental kind of radio show, but it's been how 5 years, and now we're just starting to talk about how religion can actually feed into that and vice versa. So thank you so much for enlightening us as well as the rest of the listeners out there. And listeners, thank you so much for tuning in.
Happy Monday.
Happy Monday, yeah. Wow. Not as warm as it's been in the past, but, it's still pretty warm. Let's see. In 2 weeks, Laura and I are going to be back on air, and we're going to be talking about birding in springtime. So we're going to hope that it's a little bit warmer, during that segment. But yeah, thanks to everybody for listening in. Again, this is WCBN FM Ann Arbor. And why don't we go out on this classic by George Michael called Faith.
Beautiful. Does it really start that way?
Yeah, with the organ. It's like, ah!